if you give them a structure where they can begin to internalize the importance of rules, structure, discipline, but also standards, but also it's okay to be emotionally vulnerable, they remember that. And so when they're emotionally vulnerable as young adults, they've developed a foundation for resiliency. Even if they can't name it, it comes from your exposure.
Welcome to the Raising the STEAM podcast, hosted by M. Ross, where we're dedicated to raising the STEAM leaders of tomorrow. Discover inspiring stories, lessons learned, and actionable insights from the worlds of science, technology, engineering, art, mathematics, and medicine. Connect with us and a community of dedicated parents, educators, and STEAM supporters at RaisingTheSTEAM.com and at RaisingTheSTEAM on social media. Together, let's ignite curiosity and drive change.
Welcome to the Raising the STEAM podcast. I'm your host, M. Ross. Today, I am with a brilliant psychiatrist, just an amazing person overall, and my friend, Dr. Marcel Green. Marcel, how are you?
Doing well. Doing very well. Very well.
Awesome. Awesome. So can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So I am, as you mentioned, a psychiatrist. I'm based in New York City. I have the psychiatric services of a private practice that's based in Manhattan called Hudson Minds. There we do traditional psychiatric care. I manage medications. I do therapy. I also run an interventional service that includes procedures called a transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a treatment for severe depression and OCD. I do stellate ganglion blocks. That's a nerve block procedure for specific anxiety conditions. And I also do a ketamine service, which represents the frontier of mental health care. So I run that division. Outside of work, you know, I try to live life and enjoy everything that the city has to offer. We may get into it later, but I hail from Virginia. And I moved up to New York City at age 21. And I've been there ever since. And outside of that, you know, I consider myself a Renaissance man. I have varied interests. I love traveling. I love learning from people. I love talking to people from different walks of life. And mostly I enjoy learning. And so that inspires continuous curiosity. I enjoy family and taking care of good people. And I love bringing people up to follow in my path.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, can you walk us through the path you took for your formal education?
Absolutely. And so being raised in Virginia, I went through the public school system in Southeast Virginia, called the Tidewater area, and pretty standard fare in the sense that we were mandated to go to class. I, like many other people my age, thought it was extremely boring, but I had to go there. A couple of things shaped me. So my father was in the military. My mother was a first generation immigrant. And so they set a structure where education was absolutely expected or the consequences will be faced. And so based on that environment, you know, I follow the rules. And so I essentially was told to get at least above a C. That was the standard for excellence at that time. And the reward was I could eat good food. Like they would always reward good grades with a trip to Chuck E. Cheese or something that as a little kid, that was enough. That's all I needed, to be honest. And then other little childhood ways of rewarding children. So video games or good sneakers or good clothing versus the consequence of not getting any of those things if I get below a C. So that was enough. And so maintaining that basic standard, I didn't know at the time, but well, it was enough to get into college. I will say, however, that one important step for me was discovering on my own that barrier for college entry, which was the SAT. I actually didn't even discover that that was a college requirement until maybe 2 months before I had to take it. Yes, and it's funny because it was random. So I mean, I saw advertisements on the school walls talking about the SAT as a college entry requirement, and you know, asking questions, I discovered that this was a big deal. And so I also discovered that there were practice tests, and I took it and failed completely. And so now I have this dilemma of having to figure out how to score well on this test if I want to go to college, right? And so effectively, I enrolled in a SAT prep class, and I pretty much scored well enough, thank goodness, to get into a school. Another important part of my path is that there was not much of a model in terms of how to apply for school, write essays, how to construct an application. It was all an act of discovery. And because my mother's a first generation, my father, he was in the military. They could offer basic advice, but for the most part, we all had to discover ourselves how to put together an impressive application. Also, there was a financial hurdle. And so it was all well and good to say what schools I want to go in, but once we found out the price tag, well, that limited it down to be honest, three schools. And so I applied to three schools. Luckily, I was able to get into Virginia Tech, where I met you, a friend of now 20 years. And that was an interesting process. It was my first time away from home. I wanted to be away from home, so it was amazing for me. But the act of being a student, all new, completely new. There was not much input. In fact, when my parents dropped me off at school, it was like, make sure you get good grades. But there was no real model for how to do that. And so we went in together through an engineering prep program the summer before our first year, and were exposed to some of the classwork requirements. And I initially was an engineering student. Well, let alone without much preparation, without much guidance, I failed many of my first tests, which was a pure shock to me because of how badly I failed these classes. And so the test. And so that was a wake-up call for me. But also what I discovered was that I was not interested whatsoever in any of these introductory engineering classes. And so I remember the moment, I think I got like a 14 on the engineering fundamentals first test. I walked to the library and I looked at the course catalog because I had to change my major. There's no way I'm getting a second F. And so anyway, I literally flipped through all of the potential majors and chose, without much of a frame of reference, psychology. And to be honest, my only frame of reference was the fact that probably the only class in high school that I truly enjoyed was psychology, AP psychology. Hmm. And so I chose psychology. And then I told my parents after the fact, and they hated it, right? But I was allowed to stay the course. And then taking my first psychology classes, again, I learned how to study at the college level through experience. I never studied that hard in my life. I never spent more than maybe a half hour or an hour on homework before. But now I'm having to spend 3 hours, 4 hours looking at these textbooks and having to really make sense out of content. Outside of that, I've been saying I wanted to be a physician forever, but now I'm discovering that you have to take pre-med school classes, organic chemistry, general chemistry, physics, biology. So because I was so afraid of scoring so low on a test again, and I'm discovering that your grades matter, they're going to go on a transcript for consideration by med schools, I'm understanding that this can't happen again. And so I discovered that there were tutoring centers ran by teaching assistants, the grad students of the respective departments. I literally just walked in and said, you got to teach me because I'm not understanding what these books are saying. And to be honest, I discovered people who are still friends to this day in the tutoring center. But there, I learned that, number one, there was no shame in asking for help. Number two, it could be fun. Number three, if you do slowly but surely get help and dedicate yourself to reading these chapters, even if it's so boring that you're falling asleep between paragraphs, you will progressively learn. And by taking this course, you know, I had a typical pattern. I would start off either with maybe a C in the first test at the beginning of the semester and always finish off with an A or B plus. And so this is how it went. I finished in psychology. I got my degree. The MCAT test, which is the prerequisite for getting into med school, similar challenge to the SAT. I didn't discover how serious it was until I had to study for this test. I took practice tests multiple times, failed tremendously multiple times, but then, you know, slowly but surely learned the structure of the test, which, again, asking for help, going to my pre-med department, asking for advice in terms of what am I doing wrong because I'm studying, why am I getting this low grade? Slowly but surely, I learned how to raise my score up enough so that it was acceptable for entry into med school. I also say, sorry for being long-winded, but the pre-med track, again, an act of discovery. It's pure and simple. I mean, my pre-med advisor had probably had hundreds of kids. And so I was getting advice that I found out later wasn't, was not really informative. And so me and a couple other pre-med students, we often sought advice elsewhere. So we visited medical schools at University of Virginia, Eastern Virginia Medical School. We went down to, we went up to the University of Maryland. I went down to Duke, and I literally just cold emailed some advisors in the Minority Affairs Division and said, you got to teach me because I don't know how to get into med school. Slowly but surely, I received mentorship about how to construct an application, what to say on a personal statement, how to essentially present myself. Well, I got interviews at a lot of places, a lot of places. And this was because of the advice of many good people that I had to reach out for because, you know, the advice that I got from my pre-med department was subpar. So then I got into, surprisingly enough, Columbia, moved to New York City, went to Columbia. And then again, act of discovery. My first med school test, I still say to this day, was the hardest test I ever took in my life. I mean, why? And at the same time, my classmates who came from private schools, who came from the Ivies or top tier schools, where I would hear them. I was walking out of the test saying, my God. And they were saying, let's go to the bar. That was a breeze. And
oh, man.
You know, I didn't say anything, but in my head, I knew that I had to catch up. And I knew that this was going to involve a change of what I thought normal relationship to school was. And I was going to do whatever I had to do. And so I went from, you know, studying maybe at most 4 hours of homework or to prepare for a class or a test to now studying 8 hours a day. It was real. It was intense. And, you know, also myself, my parents at this point, you know, I was responsible for paying for med school. So, you know, I'm signing away loans. I have no financial education. So I don't know, you know, that the bill is going to be due and it's substantial. I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, so I'm also in New York City. And so I'm living with a hot pot in my dorm room cooking rotisserie chickens and studying 8 hours a day. But nonetheless, what I learned prior to was that persistence pays off.
Right.
And so I made it my goal that despite the fact that I felt behind, I was going to be on the same level. And so we not only after we took tests, we got a sense of where we ranked in terms of our scores. And so I always use that as a gauge to see if I was catching up. And I took pride in doing so. So got through med school. Well, first and second years were class years. Your third year is your introduction to the hospitals. You follow around the interns and the residents and the physicians. That's when I got my next lesson in life, which is the people who do well initially are people who are groomed to know how to conform to professional expectations in a professional setting. No real prior exposure to that. And so while I was meeting requirements, so knowledge requirements, you have to give presentations to the physicians and residents. you're also being judged subjectively about how you mirrored the professional climate, this notion of professionalism that traps many of us initially trapped me. So I was getting low subjective evaluations and had no idea why. I would ask my direct advisors why, and they couldn't tell me what I could do. And to be honest, the only helpful source of information was my dean of minority affairs, who still, I still praise her. She just retired. She's a godsend, Dr. Hutchison at Columbia. So she taught me the game. So you got to present yourself in this manner. If you are challenged in any respect, it's not personal. Respond in this manner. All the subtleties of professional presentation I learned. So anyway, got through med school. And then I kind of contract the rest of the story. Went through residency. Initially, I chose surgery. I'm sure we'll talk about that later, but I ended up in my true love, which was psychiatry, which I am over 10 years in practice now. And then rising the professional ranks in a competitive environment. Now professional practice, life, everything is fun. And even though, you know, I look somewhat fondly on all the struggles, they were real at the time. We're talking about real existential crises of not knowing that you could make it to the next step. But looking back on it, I'm glad I did it because, you know, it just feels amazing.
That's an amazing story, Marcel. I mean, I knew you had a winding path, but a lot of those details, you know, even though we've known each other for 20, 25 years, I didn't know some of those details. So that's amazing. So with that winding path, how do you think that shaped your approach to your work now?
Oh, wow. So I would actually credit having to find myself both professionally and personally to shape a core confidence that when I say that I'm doing well now, I mean it. It comes from within. Like I earned every single step. And to be honest, I give credit to everyone who helped me along the way, and nobody can do it by themselves. But just knowing the work that went into living now, and you know, living now is not without its challenges, but like that core confidence came from that winding path. And just to add just a slight little bit of detail. So I initially went into surgery because, you know, it sounds cool. That's all I knew. Yeah, I didn't know anything about the field. It just sounds
all right.
and then in the residency, you know, then it gets real. You know, I'm working 100 hours.
A lot of hours.
my days off only follow 24-hour shifts, which I'm working every 3 days. And again, you know, just consistent with me, I kind of meet the challenge where it is. And, you know, I have this inner voice that says that, you know, it's not going to beat me, which, to be honest, comes back from the culture that I grew up with, playing sports, but also kind of I also credit that attitude to some of the hip hop culture that I grew up with. It's meeting the challenge head on, taking pride in struggle, the struggle, so to speak. So anyway, so when I was faced with that work climate, to be honest, like I met it. But what I didn't ask, and again, this comes from mentorship, and this is what I would impart upon people coming up after me, is that what I didn't ask is, does this fit me? Is struggle a reflection of, is this work a reflection of my true passion? Can I have the most impact here? And that results from my work matching my passion. I can do the hours, but am I making the impact? Is this a passion? Because if that's not the case, it will bury you. So even though I felt like I was able to manage the hours and the grueling nature of the culture, what I did notice is that outside of work, I was very short with people, irritable, or sleeping all the time. And so 3 years in, I started to ask these questions. And I reached out to mentors. I asked them, especially mid-career surgeons, I asked them what their life was like. Later career surgeons, I asked them what the trajectory of their professional life was. And I came to the conclusion, I don't want your life.
You're right.
I mean, you know, the fun parts are fun, but I just don't want that path. And so I had to go back to the drawing board and you know, just contact people who were strangers to me in different branches of medicine to ask them the same questions. What brings you to work every day? What was the trajectory of your career? What were the challenges you faced personally and professionally? And I fell back on what was an initial love for me, which was psychiatry. And so having to go leave surgery and go into psychiatry was a bit of a grind. But, you know, I got into it. Luckily, I was able to stay in New York City. I did all of my training here. And looking back on it, as well as the passion I feel doing my work now, was the right decision. In fact, it was probably one of the landmark decisions of my life. And I'm glad I made it early because I meet a lot of people who are trying to understand feeling down or frustrated later in life, our age now, maybe perhaps 40s, and then discovering, well, I followed a path that wasn't my passion. So I'm glad I asked those questions in my late 20s.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, you faced a lot of challenges along your way. So what do you feel are some of the biggest challenges facing young people who are interested in medicine or other STEAM fields today?
Yes. So I think one big challenge is that we don't necessarily have equal access to mentorship. And mentorship, not only mentorship, but even early childhood adolescent guidance that teaches us the importance of rules, the importance of structure, the importance of delayed gratification, which is big. And it's a big to counterbalance what we are exposed to as youths, which is fun. You know, we have companies that are dedicated to selling us things for pleasure, leisure. They want nothing more than for us to get lost in pleasure. And when you're exposed to that influence from a child, if you don't have the counterbalance telling you that it's worth it to delay gratification, it's worth it to do things that are boring, then you'll never learn it. And some people grow up in environments where that is a part of what they're raised with, and so can more readily fall into success professionally. But if you don't have that, you have to find it. You may never find it. And so when I tell you about some of the experiences where I had to discover what ultimately set my path in a certain direction, I may never have discovered it. And so when I talk to, for example, childhood friends who, you know, they may have regrets about where they're at now, the difference is I discovered something and they didn't, because we both didn't have it. And so that's a challenge. And so what I would say is that, you know, a lot of times we tell young people to imagine what you would want to do when you grow up, but ask questions, how do I get there? And if you're not getting the answers from around you, find these answers, because you can't expect it'll come to you.
So what can parents and educators do to create a supportive environment that encourages curiosity and, you know, sort of resilience, which is one of the things that we talked about in children who are aspiring for these type of either medicine or other STEAM related fields?
Yes. So parents and all adult authority figures, to be honest, because, you know, you never know what's going to be influential to a young person. It can be a consistently cool school official, the guard, the bus driver. It can be anybody. So anybody that has any role in giving advice, impart these things. And so the importance of structure. I would say to people who have more consistent contact, like a caregiver, parent, consistency of structure is vital. Even if working a lot of hours, which limits your ability to be present, to be honest, which was the case for my parents. You know, they were both working most of the day. You know, I would let myself in after school. I had free reign to leave the house, roam the neighborhood, and come back. The only rule, and that's the point of consistency, because that's something I internalized, was that be home when the lights are on. Don't get below a C or else. And at that time, it was acceptable to use corporal punishment. And trust me, I got it. So, but the point the point is consistency. And so this is the rule. It's upheld every single time, and your rewards are tied to adherence to this rule. So even though my parents didn't necessarily have the time to be present a lot of the times, and to be honest, didn't necessarily know how to help me with some of those complicated math lessons, what they did in part was that following rules matter. There are consequences to your actions. I would also say another thing that I didn't necessarily have consistently, even though I did have it a little bit, but I would say what's important is that create an environment where being emotionally vulnerable is acceptable and that you can talk about it. Because it does take getting through challenges that, you know, we discover in life takes facing vulnerability. And what young people do is they absorb things from their environment. And in fact, from a psychological perspective, all of those influences you want the youths to internalize, because that guides them in those initial lost years of young adulthood. And so if you give them a structure where they can begin to internalize the importance of rules, structure, discipline, but also standards, but also it's okay to be emotionally vulnerable, they remember that. And so when they're emotionally vulnerable as young adults, they've developed a foundation for resiliency. Even if they can't name it, it comes from your exposure. So I would say emotional vulnerability, also teaching that it's okay to fail. For me, I got that by participating in sports. And so you're going to fail. You're going to lose. But, you know, some kids don't do sports or don't do a skilled hobby like an instrument. So if that's not the case, then teaching that it is okay to fail, and the fact you're supposed to fail, you're supposed to. And so, and then also, you know, asking what you can't provide and teaching your kid to reach out for help if you need it. And so if you can't necessarily help your child with the math lesson, well, don't stop there. Show them how to get help. And the kids internalize all of this. And so when they're young adults, they do it on their own. And I look at you, to be honest, because when we were freshmen together, I was so amazed about how disciplined you were. So you internalized a lot from your youth that, to be honest, you took forward out of the gate freshman year of high school. Like, I was looking to you like, man, I got a 14 on these tests and you get A's. And so, okay, so let me up my game here. And so that just goes to show that it pays off.
Yeah, man, that's some incredible advice, some amazing advice. Really appreciate that. So, I mean, a lot of the things that you were talking about in advising, I'm sure it took a lot of years of experience studying and just introspection and a whole lot. You know, recently there's been a lot of news about artificial intelligence and how that might affect all types of industries. So how do you see artificial intelligence impacting psychiatry and mental health care in the future?
Yes. And again, it's these are just early thoughts because, you know, we're early in the development of that technology. But I mean, things that we have seen that could potentially influence my particular field are, number one, you are seeing, well, we're hearing about artificial intelligence contributing to misinformation. Articles based on false information are being presented as true, or just being presented. And so if somebody doesn't have a discerning eye, they would take it as true. So that has relevance because, you know, whereas we see now a problem of people primarily getting mental health advice from not the best sources online, I can only imagine that that could worsen in the setting where artificial intelligence is just spitting out misinformation. I would say potential upsides are that it could improve access to mental health care. if development is, and to be honest, we see this in my field. I mean, there's a lot of excitement about learning artificial intelligence and how it's available now and how we can use it to build systems of mental health care, improve access. And so I do think that it can help improve access tremendously. If, for example, like a ChatGPT can be refined to actually give credible information, helpful information, if somebody asks, what do I do if I'm suicidal? Well, that's a victory for access. That's a victory for access. And so gift and a curse. We'll see how it turns out.
So, I mean, your journey has been pretty remarkable, and I think it's a lot of things in there that, even though we're talking 20, 30 years ago where you kind of started, a lot of things in there that are applicable today to a lot of the youth. But if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, especially regarding a career in the STEAM-related field, what would that advice be?
Well, that's easy for me because I'm a child and an adult psychiatrist, so I talk to kids all the time. And so it does allow me to kind of remember how it was, remember some of the challenges that I may have forgotten. And so I think one thing that I talk about consistently with both, you know, people who are seeing me for care, but it would apply globally for young people, is that, and in fact, it would double over as something to impart on young people if you have a role in their lives. I would tell the younger me that your world is so small. And so the reason I say that is because we build our identity based on what's around us in the immediate environment. And so let's take development of your identity in middle school and high school, right? It's so important to you to have those shoes. It's so important to you that nobody calls you out in public. It's so important to you if you get disrespected. And so I would tell the younger me and try to be just an influence to say that it is important. However, there's a bigger world out there. And I tell a lot of young people all the time that even if you feel that this social embarrassment is the end of the world, literally a year out of high school, you may never see any of these folks again. They will never have any role in your life again. And so if you're able to connect into a larger perspective, it can help with emotional development tremendously, actually. So I would say keep that in mind. What else? I don't think I talked about fostering the environment for curiosity, and that would go into telling my younger self something. What I had and what I credit for a curiosity that I still have is that I was allowed to roam. And nowadays in this climate where we feel like we have to hover over our youths to protect them against very real dangers, we may lose sight of the fact that roaming, being free to imagine and follow your childhood passions is the prerequisite for fostering curiosity as a youth. Nurture that. And I also tell a lot of young people that it's okay to be by yourself sometimes, you know, even though you might feel that you should be doing what other people look like they're doing. They look like they're having fun. That alone time is extremely important. So to become comfortable in that space. And if you're not comfortable, well, that's an opportunity to develop hobbies so that you can entertain yourself. So that can be pleasure reading. Yeah. That can be taking pleasure with instruments. I'm a big fan of encouraging skilled activities in alone time just to create comfort being alone, because that translates to just resiliency later.
Wow. Marcel, what an amazing conversation this has been, man. You really, really have come with a lot of great little tidbits and nuggets that I'm sure are going to be really helpful for folks, man. And it's been really, really great speaking with you. And listen, man, congratulations on everything. It's been awesome to be able to see where you started and you getting where you are today.
You too. I'm telling you, like I'm, because the focus is on me, I'll take that. But you're great, my friend. And so I definitely took a lot of cues from you. And I've mentioned that to you many times. And so it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to see what you've achieved. And to be honest, I invite anybody to reach out to me if needed. Happy to talk to anybody who would like to.
Awesome. Thank you. All right, my friend. Well, take care.
Absolutely. Have a good one.